tire iron. A plastic box that contained a drill, but what caught my eye was a length of coat hanger wire that had been repurposed into a long hook, for jimmying the lock when the keys were left inside. I picked it up and straightened it out. It would be perfect. I didn't want any blood in the truck. I slid back onto the passenger seat and shut the door behind me. I rolled down my window. The smell of Brad's last cigarette still lingered in the cab, plus there was something else. The chemical odor of distilled alcohol coming from Brad's breath. Maybe also his body. He had begun to snore, high nasal rasps on each outtake of breath. I grabbed him by the shoulder and shook him as hard as I could, and he showed no signs of coming out of his deep sleep. I wondered if the combination of alcohol, how much had he drunk today, and the chloral hydrate would eventually kill him, but I couldn't take the risk that it wouldn't. I got onto my knees on the passenger seat. I pushed Brad's head away from me so that it fell facing the driver's side window. It was still tipped back, and there was space between his thick neck and the truck's headrest. I circled the coat hanger wire around his neck and twisted the ends together so that the wire was tight against his neck. I took out the Leatherman from my backpack and clipped the excess wire from the coat hanger so that the twisted together part was only about an inch long. I gripped the ends with the tip of the Leatherman pliers, and I twisted, tightening the wire until I knew that Brad was dead. Part 3. Hide the Bodies Well.
Chapter 27. Kimball. I couldn't sleep. This was nothing new to me, especially when I was working on a case. I checked the clock on my bedside table. It was a little after 3 in the morning. Pie Wacket the cat was sleeping on my discarded clothes on the floor. He looked cold, curled into a ball like a woolly bear caterpillar that's pretending it's dead. He probably wondered why those metal strips along his apartment's floor hadn't started making burbling sounds and getting warm. Late October had turned cold, but I liked to hold out till November at least, before turning the heat on. I thought of getting out of bed and going to see what was playing on Turner Classic Movies, but knew that if I did, I would never get back to sleep again. I needed to be at least a little sharp for the following day. Ted Severson had been murdered on Friday night, and it had now just tipped over into the following Wednesday. Almost a whole week. We had a prime suspect, this Brad Daggett character, but he'd pulled a runner, and no one could find him. I'd spent the day up in Maine in the company of the mostly helpful Kennewick police force, keeping an eye on Daggett's house, checking any and all leads as to his whereabouts. He was our man, for sure. After Miranda Severson identified our sketch as possibly being Brad Daggett, I'd checked the system, and Daggett was there. He'd been arrested twice, 5 years earlier on suspicion of domestic assault, and 2 years ago on a DUI. I'd called him with the number that Miranda had given me, but he didn't pick up. Then I called the local police and asked them to swing by and check to see if Brad Daggett was home, maybe do some initial questioning, ask him if he had any information on the death of Ted Severson. They did as I asked, but he wasn't at his house. I told them it could wait till the next day, that I'd be questioning the primary witness in the morning, and we'd know more then. I printed Daggett's most recent mugshot and took it to Rachel Price's apartment in Somerville the following morning. When she looked at the picture, she hopped a little on her toes and said, "Oh, that's him. That's definitely him." "That's the man you saw entering the house at 6 o'clock on Friday night?" "Yes, that's him. I'm sure of it." That had been Tuesday morning. I called the sheriff, then driven up myself. Daggett was still nowhere to be found. Not at either of the construction sites that he was supervising, and not at his home, one of a string of rental cottages that he owned along Kennewick Beach. White paint and green trim. Made me think of my own childhood vacations at Wells Beach, just a little farther north. When it was clear he wasn't home and wasn't coming back any time soon, I'd tried out the key I'd found hidden in Ted Severson's bedroom drawer. It fit Brad's cottage door. Why did Ted have a key to his general contractor's house? Had they been having an affair? I peered into the tiny, immaculate cottage, but didn't enter yet. A local judge granted a warrant just after his lunch break, and we searched the place, finding nothing. I'd been kicking myself all day that I hadn't acted faster after Miranda gave me Brad Daggett's name. I should have brought his mugshot immediately to Rachel Price, but Miranda's half-hearted identification hadn't left me with much hope. Of course, now it seemed abundantly clear that Miranda only identified Brad because she felt she had to, and she was covering herself. And she must have been the one who had warned Brad to stay away from his house and turn off his phone. It was the oldest story in the book. The wife had had her boyfriend kill her husband. The curveball was that hidden key in Ted's drawer, the key to Brad's cottage in Maine. Was it Miranda's key, and she had hidden it in her husband's drawer? Possible, I supposed. By early afternoon, we put an all-points bulletin out for Brad and his vehicle. His ex-wife had been interviewed, plus several employees and work colleagues. No one had seen him since the previous day at lunch, when he bought a large meatball sub at a pizza place in York that he frequented. He disappeared. I left Maine late in the afternoon, taking I-95 back down toward Boston. On the way, I received an excited call from Billy Elkins, the officer I'd tasked with looking into Lily Kintner, the woman that Miranda Severson said she knew in Winslow, Massachusetts. He'd found out a lot. Lily Kintner worked at Winslow College in the library department, apparently under the name of Lily Hayward, but she owned a house on Poplar Road in Winslow under her real name. Most importantly, Ted and Lily had shared a flight back from London on the 20th of September. I pumped my fist in the car and took down her address. Asking Billy to check passenger manifests had been a total hunch, but an educated one, and I couldn't believe that it had paid off. As soon as Miranda had identified Lily Kintner as the one person she knew who lived in Winslow, I had wondered if Lily Kintner was the same Lily Kintner who was the daughter of David Kintner, easily my favorite living novelist. I didn't know much about Kintner's daughter, just that her name was Lily, and that she was born in America while David had been living in Connecticut, married to an American artist named Sharon Henderson. Mather College was in Connecticut, and if Lily was Miranda's age, then she'd be just about the right age to be Kintner's daughter. The thing about David Kintner was that he wasn't just famous for being a novelist. He had become infamous for accidentally killing his second wife in a drunk driving accident in England. It had been huge news in England, less so in America. I followed it because I was a fan of his books. He'd done time and just been released, less than a month ago. It would make sense that his American daughter had flown over to London to see him. I had also learned from Miranda Severson that Ted had flown to London recently for work, so it occurred to me that Ted and this Lily Kintner had possibly met on an airplane. I had Billy take a shot and check the manifests, and got a hit. After a fruitless day trying to find Brad Daggett, it felt good that some detective work had actually paid off. She must have been the reason he traveled to Winslow that day, even though she probably had nothing to do with his death. When I reached the I-95-I-93 split, instead of getting onto I-93 to head into Boston, I stayed on I-95, looping west toward Winslow. I didn't expect much to come from questioning Lily Kintner, but I needed to check it out. She'd been home, and she did turn out to be David Kintner's daughter, just as I suspected. She lived in a book-filled house on a pond with only a few other houses on its leaf-plastered shore. She greeted me at the door, looking a little disheveled, her eyes taking a moment to focus on my face. I wondered if I'd woken her from a nap. She invited me in. I asked her about Ted Severson, and she told me she knew him, but only from the newspaper reports of his death, and from knowing that he had married someone she knew from college. She offered coffee, and I accepted. While she made it, I looked over her bookshelves, finding a row of all of David Kintner's novels. I ran a finger across their spines, remembering pictures I'd seen of him. Tall and angular, with a thatch of white hair. A drinker's face, sallow and hollow-cheeked. Lily returned with the coffee, her hair pushed back behind her ears, her sleepy eyes now sharp and watchful. I told her I knew her father's books, was a fan, actually, and she seemed unimpressed, as though she'd heard way too much about her father's genius. I told her I knew about the situation in England, and that allowed me to bring up the flight she'd shared with Ted Severson. Something clicked in her luminous green eyes, and she told me that she had met a man on the plane, and that he'd seemed familiar, and it was probably him. They'd spoken at length, and it was possible she told him who she was and where she lived. We found a picture on the Internet, and she confirmed that it was Ted Severson she had spoken to, but she claimed to have no idea why he would have come to Winslow. I believe some of what she told me. I believe that she hadn't known Ted Severson had come to her town to look for her, and I believe that she was surprised that I'd shown up at her house. But I didn't believe that she hadn't figured out that the man in the plane was the husband of a friend of hers. It made no sense. But why would she lie to me about such a thing? At her door, I put my hand in my pocket, my fingers touching the key we now knew belonged to Brad Daggett's cottage in Maine. Even so, I asked Lily if she'd mind if I tried her door with it. I just wanted to gauge her reaction. She seemed perplexed, but not worried. I left, not really knowing what to think. But I did know why Ted Severson had gone to Winslow that day. He'd met Lily Kintner on a plane, and he'd fallen in love with her. That much was sure. I empathized. In fact, I'd been thinking about Lily Kintner almost nonstop since meeting her the day before. She was beautiful, that much I remembered, but I was having trouble reconstructing her facial features in my mind. I could picture her long red hair and her green eyes, so much like a cat's, but her face kept slipping in and out of my mind's grasp. But more than her physical presence, I had been taken in by her almost otherworldly self-possession. And, by the way, she inhabited her book-lined cottage in the woods of Winslow. Was she lonely out there all alone? Or was she one of those rarities, a human who didn't need other humans in her life? It was something that I intended to find out. My younger sister Emily, who knows me better than anyone in the world, told me recently that my problem with relationships is that I fall in love with every woman I'm attracted to. "Don't most guys?" I said. "No," she said. "Most guys just want to sleep with all the women they're attracted to. The last thing they want to do is fall in love. You call yourself a detective and you don't know that? Trust me, I also want to sleep with these women." "Yeah, but then you fall in love with them, and either they break your heart or..." "Can we talk about your love life now?" I interrupted. It was how I got Emily to change the subject when she was analyzing my failed romances. Pyewacket stirred, which meant it was 5 a.m. He leaped onto my bed, prepared to breathe on my eyelids to wake me up, but I swung my legs out from under the covers before he had a chance. I let him out of my apartment's side door, which led to the fire escape. He darted out, nimbly walking on the metal slats, heading down to the small backyard, where it was his job to protect our kingdom from falling leaves and rogue squirrels. I got back into bed, now certain that there was no chance I'd get any more sleep. I kept a spiral-bound notebook and a pen on top of the pile of books by my bed. It was supposed to be an idea book, a place to record late-night thoughts about cases I was working on, but also lines of poetry. I still considered myself a poet, something no one in the forest knew about, even though I'd lost the ability to write anything but limericks these days. I told myself I was at least writing something, and that maybe it would help me think about cases. Earlier the day before, I'd written these two. "There once was a husband named Ted, who met his end in a volley of lead. It was clear he was rich, and his wife was a bitch, so it's not a surprise that he's dead. There once was a girl named Miranda. It was clear that no one could stand her. But beneath all that crass was an excellent ass, so the rich men all lined up to land her." To the same page, I added the following. "There once was a novelist's daughter, whose eyes were the green of seawater. I hoped to remove her clothing to prove that naked she'd look even hotter." I wondered, not for the first time, why my limericks always turned out dirty. I tried to come up with one about Brad Daggett, but failed. Instead, I got up, made a full pot of coffee, and began to get ready to go to work. I reached my desk at just past 7, calling up and checking in with the Kennewick Chief of Police, and finding out that Brad Daggett never returned to his house. "I'm not surprised," I said half to myself. "Keep a patrol car there, though, just in case, even though he's obviously made a run for it." "Now, we talked with a girlfriend of his last night," said Chief Ireland. his voice raspy, like he was fighting a cold. Polly Grenier. She's kind of a fixture at Cooley's, the bar where Brad Daggett liked to hang out. They were an on-and-off thing. Years and years, actually. They went to high school together. She know anything? She didn't know anything about where he might be. I asked her when she last saw him, though, and she told me she was with him Friday night. Last Friday night? That's what she said. They were drinking at Cooley's and wound up back at his place. She says she spent the night there. You sure she had the day right? No, not sure, but we can check. If they were at Cooley's and left together, folks in the bar will remember. It's a small town, and people notice stuff like that. You'll check it out for me. Sure will. And one more thing, I said. Have one of your patrols swing back to the Severson house that Daggett was building, and any other houses that Daggett might have the keys for. If he's still in the area, it makes sense he might be hiding out in one of them. Check all the cottages, too, that he owns on the beach. We check them. Okay, thanks, Chief Ireland. Call me Jim, okay? Will do, I said. I sat at my desk for a while after the phone call, worrying about Daggett's alibi and how solid it might be. It couldn't be real, that much I knew. He must have gotten this girlfriend of his to agree that they were together on Friday night. If that was the case, then the alibi would crack faster than a window in a hurricane. I wrote her name down in the notebook in front of me, circling it several times. Then my partner, Roberta James, swung by, depositing an Egg McMuffin on my desk. 2-for-1 menu item, so I thought of you. And I caught her up on what I'd heard that morning. After she left, I wrote a few more lines under Polly Grenier's name in the notebook. Why would she lie for Brad? Why did Ted have a key for Brad's house? Why did Lily Kintner lie to me? I was about to call Police Chief Jim Ireland back, tell him I wanted to come up and talk with this Polly Grenier, when he called me instead.
You better come up here, he said. There's a body at the house Daggett was building.
Is it him? I asked, already standing, pulling on my jacket, checking my pocket for my car keys.
No. It's not a him at all. It's a woman. I haven't seen her yet. But they're pretty sure it's Miranda Severson. Her head's bashed in.
I'll be right there, I said, and hung up the phone. I grabbed James, who had just settled at her desk, and told her we were heading back up to Maine.
Chapter 28. Lily. After making sure that Brad was dead, I removed the coat hanger wire from around his neck. I grasped him by his denim coat and managed to drag him across the truck's front seat onto the passenger side, where I strapped him in with a seatbelt. I tilted the seat a little bit back so that he tilted with it, then zipped his coat all the way up, turning up the sheepskin-lined collar so that it covered the ligature marks on his neck. If someone saw us in the car, he'd look like a dozing passenger. At least, that's what I hoped he'd look like. I started the truck and drove out of the driveway and back onto the road, keeping the headlights off till I turned on Micmac. I checked the fuel gauge, the needle hovering somewhere between 3/4 and full, and I thought it would be enough gas to get us down to Connecticut. I had been prepared to get gas at a self-service station, paying with cash inside, but was glad that I didn't have to. So far, no one had seen me in Maine, and I was planning on keeping it that way. I drove north, toward the entrance ramp for I-95. I got off Micmac before hitting Kennewick Beach, knowing that if the police were on to Brad already, they were probably staked out in front of his cottage. I would have loved to go back there, get a few of his things to make it look like he'd truly made a run for it. But it wasn't worth the risk. Before hitting the interstate, I pulled into a closed auto shop called Mike's, one of those backwoods garages surrounded by junked vehicles. With my lights off, I pulled into a row of junkers and got out of the truck. I found a car that looked as though it hadn't been moved through the last 2 winters, and, using my Leatherman, I removed its main license plate. Then swapped it with a license plate from Brad's truck. It took about 5 minutes. No sound except for that steady wind that rustled the remaining leaves in the trees. Licenses swapped, I got back in the truck, the cab light briefly illuminating Brad, his head now lolling unnaturally to the side. I turned away from him, and my eye caught the plastic EasyPass transmitter glued to the inside of the windshield. There were tolls on the interstate, two in Maine, then another when the highway briefly passed through New Hampshire. I debated whether it was better to zip through tolls with the EasyPass and possibly be tracked, or whether I should remove it and go through cash tolls. I decided that paying cash was better and pried the transmitter off the windshield, throwing it into the woods next to the garage. Brad really did just look like someone's husband sleeping off a drunk, and I would take my chances on anyone recognizing me. My hair was my most distinctive feature, and it was hidden under my hat. I didn't need to worry. The toll booth operators barely looked at either Brad or me on the entire 4-hour drive to my old neighborhood in Connecticut. There was no one on the roads, and I probably could have made the trip in 3.5, but I kept strictly to the speed limits, staying in the right-hand lane while cargo trucks rumbled past me in the passing lanes. I kept the radio off, but somewhere around Worcester, Brad's body shifted and made a gas-expelling moan. I'd been prepared for this, telling myself that dead bodies make sounds, but I still jumped about 2 inches in my seat when it happened. After that, I turned on the radio, flipping between crappy stations until somewhere in Connecticut I found a late-night jazz show on a commercial-free station way left on the dial. I didn't particularly like jazz, since it reminded me of my parents, but I could recognize a number of standards. On Green Dolphin Street by Miles Davis, segued into Nat King Cole's Autumn Leaves. I listened to the words, trying to keep my mind away from the fact that I was driving through the night with a dead man as my passenger. Even with the radio turned up loud, I heard two more expulsions and the cab of the truck filled with the smell of both urine and excrement. I thought about that black stray cat I killed years ago when I was a girl, and the way I'd been shocked by the presence of shit. I remember how the disgust over that dead cat had made me feel even happier that I'd killed it. It was the same with Brad Daggett next to me in the truck. He'd gotten what he deserved. Maybe even better than he'd deserved. He was dead now and couldn't hurt anyone, but I still had to deal with his disgusting body. And I had to survive the remainder of this trip. I put a little more weight on the gas pedal, thought it couldn't hurt to go a little bit over the speed limit. The miles ticked by through There's a Small Hotel and Chet Baker's Almost Blue, and Dinah Washington singing This Bitter Earth. The songs began to fuzz in and out of range as I got closer to home, but I didn't flip away, preferring snatches of old music to furniture warehouse ads and bad talk radio. I turned the radio off when I reached Shepog, listened to silence as I wound along the familiar tree-lined streets. I passed the driveway from Monk's house, instinctively turning my head and seeing a single second-floor light still burning. I guessed that my mother had fallen asleep reading, the way she did every night, books splayed open across her chest, lamp still on. I took the next right, down the weed-choked driveway that led to the empty farmhouse. I killed the truck's headlights and slowed to a crawl. Just as it had been in Maine, it was a cloudless night in Connecticut, the black sky crowded with bright stars. The farmhouse, unadorned and colorless, rose up out of a yard that had become a pasture. A single tree, planted too close to the house, seemed to be enveloping the structure, one of its branches having punctured the roof. I stepped out of the truck and was flooded with the familiar piney smell of the surrounding woods. I took my penlight and waded out into the adjacent meadow, its dried-out grasses crackling under my feet. I had been back to this meadow a few times since childhood, but this was the first time I'd been here at night since that summer evening when I'd killed Chet. I walked toward where I thought the well was, only turning the penlight on when I thought I was close, pointing the beam down at the ground. It took 5 minutes, but I found the well cover, covered by the grass I'd flattened over its top so many years ago. I propped the penlight on the cover's wooden edge, angling it slightly up so that I'd be able to see its weak beam, then walked back to the truck. Except for the rainfall of the day before, it had been a dry September and October in New England, and the ground of the meadow was soft but not muddy. Keeping my eye on the penlight's beam, I drove the truck from the driveway onto the meadow, bumping up and over a few rocks that were all that remained of an ancient stone wall. Brad Daggett jolted back and forth on his seat, emitting another expulsion of gas. My window was rolled down, my head halfway out. I pulled the truck up to the left of the well and kept it running while I got out and circled around to the well cover. With my gloves still on, I ripped away at the meadow grass and loosened the cover. I pulled it away gently, trying not to break the rotten wood, and laid it next to the well opening. I picked up the penlight. In its beam, I could see worms writhing in the bare earth where the well cover had laid. I pointed the beam down the well, seeing only the rocks and dirt that covered Chet. I imagined what was left of him down there. A withered corpse. Some paint-splattered clothes. A few rotted picture frames. A pair of dark-rimmed glasses. The world turned suddenly dark, and a slight jolt of fear went through me. I looked up, and it was a single scrap of cloud that was blanking the moon. I watched it pass by, and the world was flooded again with moonlight. I opened the passenger door of the truck, unbuckled Brad, and he tumbled out on his own accord, landing face first onto the ground, one of his feet, in his large work boots, snagging on the edge of the door. I loosened his boot, and his leg followed his body down onto the ground. He was about 3 feet from the well hole, but even so, it was not easy to move his bulk. I wound up rolling him over several times till his head and torso were flopped into the well. Then I lifted his heavy feet till he slid over the edge. He hit the bottom of the well with a splintery thump, sending up a rush of acrid air. "Brad, meet Chet. Chet, meet Brad." I pulled the cover back onto the well, tapped down the sides, and replaced the meadow grass, sweeping it over like hair across a bald spot. I checked my watch. It was nearly 3 a.m. It was all going just as I had planned. Before I got back into the truck to drive to New York City, I took a moment just for myself, standing under the starry night, surrounded by nothing but darkness and nature. "Rare breed of animal," my father had once called me, and that's what I felt like. Totally alive, and totally alone. My only companion at that moment was my younger self, the one who tipped Chet down that well. I imagined she was there with me. We locked eyes, not needing to speak to each other. We understood that survival was everything. It was the meaning of life. And to take another life was, in many ways, the greatest expression of what it meant to be alive. I blinked, and my younger self disappeared. She came back into me, and together we drove to New York City. I was back in Shepog by 10 in the morning. I had driven the truck into the city, cruising around the Lower East Side, till I found a place to park not too far from a subway station. It was a litter-choked block filled with shuttered shops. It was nearly dawn, but loud music blasted from a parked car half a block away. I parked under a flickering street lamp. I had worn gloves the entire night, so there were no prints to wipe off. But I did it anyway, using a small towel that I found in the truck's glove compartment. After wiping everything down, I spread the towel out and draped it over the soiled passenger seat. Then I gathered any paperwork that had Brad's name on it in the truck and took it with me. There was a nearby trash bin, and I pushed the papers down into the stew of pizza crusts and coffee cups. Then I dropped the keys to the truck on the pavement next to the driver's side, where they would catch the light. I hoped that the person who first spotted the dropped keys would not be some do-gooder who would alert the authorities. I was counting on the likelihood that the truck would be in several pieces in a chop shop by the time the sun came up. I took the subway to Grand Central, bought a ticket on the Metro North commuter rail to Shepog. It was an hour wait, and I drank coffee and ate a greasy donut, and watched as the station slowly filled with early morning commuters. I managed to doze a little on the train ride to my hometown and woke up shivering from the cold that had gotten into my bones from the long, sleepless night. From Shepog Station, I walked the 3 miles to Monk's house, staying on a trail that skirted an unused portion of rail line. I hadn't lived in Shepog for close to 10 years, but I didn't want to risk getting spotted by someone I knew. When my mother opened the door to me, a large mug of coffee in her hand, she said, "Darling, there you are." And for a brief moment, I wondered if I'd told her I'd be there, before realizing that she was covering for herself in case she'd forgotten about a visit from me. "Were you expecting me?" I asked, walking into the house. "No." "Was I? He's not coming today, is he?" The he she was referring to was my father, who was moving back to America and back into Monk's house. I'd arranged it over my last trip to London. Long story short, my father needed to live with someone who would look after him in his fragile mental state, and my mother needed money to pay her bills. I'd brokered a deal and had no idea if it would work or not, but it was at least worth a try. Or that was what I was telling myself. "This weekend, Mum," I said, making my way to the coffee pot in the kitchen. "What are you doing here, and what are you wearing? You look like a cat burglar." Over coffee, I told my mother that I had been traveling for work, picking up college archival material first in Maine, then in New York City. I told her that I'd left my car in Maine and flown from Portland down to New York City, but that I missed my flight back. I told her I'd decided to come out to Shepog, see my mother, maybe get a ride up to Maine to get my car. It was a ludicrous story, I know, but my mother, for all her supposed instinct, was incredibly gullible, for the simple reason that she wasn't interested enough in other people's stories to properly process them. "I don't know, Lily. I have my pottery group today." "It's only about a 3-hour drive to Maine," I lied. "Afterward, I thought maybe you could follow me back down to Winslow. We could have a mother-daughter dinner. You could spend the night." She thought about it, but I knew she'd agree. For some inexplicable reason, my mother was always trying to get invited to my house up in Winslow. She liked the university setting and my tiny cottage, her words, and she liked that I cooked for her. I knew that she'd drive me to Maine if it meant she could come to Winslow. "Okay, darling," she said. "How exciting, a spontaneous trip to Maine, just you and me." It took a few hours to get her ready, but we were on the road by noon, me driving her old Volvo. I hadn't properly slept in about 30 hours, and the thought of spending another 4 hours behind the wheel of a car was not a pleasant one. But everything had gone perfectly, and it was nearly over. We spent most of the trip talking about my father. "I hope he doesn't expect conjugal relations," she said, not for the first time. "You're not even married, so it would hardly be conjugal," I said. "You know what I mean." "I wouldn't worry about it. You're not even going to recognize him. He's not the same as he was before going to prison." "Well, I should hope not." "He can't be alone in the house, not at night anyway. He has panic attacks. You don't need to be near him at all times, but he needs to know where you are." "Yes, you've told me." I had told her several times. Still, I knew she wasn't prepared for what had become of her ex-husband. He had always had quirks and phobias. He was scared of the dark, scared of crossing city streets, scared of sitting in the back seat of cars. It was hard to understand, because he was also a man who had zero fear of speaking in front of large audiences. A man who would sneak out of his wife's bedroom after she had fallen asleep and let his mistress into the house and have sex with her on the living room couch. A man who had climbed halfway up the outside of the Pilgrim Monument in Provincetown on a bet. But that side of my father, the reckless side, had disappeared after what had happened with Gemma, his second wife. He'd met her after the divorce with my mother had been finalized. He'd been living at a hotel on the Old Brompton Road in London. Gemma Daniels was an aspiring novelist, 1 year younger than me, who had probably come to my father's favorite pub for the sole reason of meeting him. They became inseparable, marrying only 6 months after they'd met. One of the drawbacks to living in London for my father was that the English tabloids cared about the bad behavior of writers almost as much as they cared about the bad behavior of footballers and pop stars. My father and Gemma were photographed having screaming matches on the street. They were chided in headlines such as "Dirty Davy and His Child Bride." This was all before the accident, before my father plowed his 1986 Jaguar into a tree after drunkenly leaving a weekend house party late on a Saturday night. Gemma was in the passenger seat and broke her neck when she went through the windshield. My father, who always wore a seatbelt, was uninjured. He managed to call for an emergency vehicle, but he didn't manage to exit the Jaguar to check on Gemma. It wouldn't have made a difference. She had died instantly. Still, word got out that he had been found cowering in his vehicle, his wife sprawled across the roadside hedge. It was deemed manslaughter by gross negligence, and my father was sent to prison for 2 years. The sentence was cut to 1 year on appeal, and he'd been released in early September. I visited him where he'd been staying at a friend's house in the Cotswolds and asked him to come back to America, to live with my mother. David still had substantial money, and my mother, after leaving her teaching because of a disagreement with her department head, had been struggling to pay the bills. Monk's house was in a reverse mortgage. My father, tears in his eyes, had agreed to move back to Connecticut.
"And you're not far away, Lil. You'll come and visit all the time, won't you?"
My father, who was 68 years old, had sounded like a small boy speaking to his mother before being sent to boarding school.
"This is pretty," my mother said as I wound her Volvo toward Kennewick Cove.
It was still light out, but the sun was low in the west, casting long shadows across the road. The sky was a deep electric blue. I pulled into the parking lot of the Admiral's Inn, where I'd left my car less than 24 hours earlier. It was still there. Before driving back to Winslow, my mother and I stretched our legs, walking down to the edge of the beach, looking out at the slate-colored ocean.
"I always loved the ocean, but your father hated it."
"Yes, he does," I said, and laughed. "He said it was like looking at death."
"It's like looking at death and everyone saying how lovely it is," my mother said in an English accent, mimicking my father.
"Right. That's what he always said. What was the other one?"
"I love the beach. Everything except the fucking sand, the fucking sun, and the fucking water."
"Yes, I remember that." What he meant was that the only thing he liked about the beach was the girls in bathing suits. We laughed together, then my mother shivered from the cold, and we got back into our respective cars to drive to Winslow. I was tempted to drive north along Micmac Road a little ways to see if there was any activity at Ted Miranda's house, but decided not to risk it.
I would find out soon enough how long it took the police to discover Miranda's body. I turned south instead, taking the fastest route to I-95. At a little before 6, I pulled into the driveway in Winslow, my mother still behind me. There were no police officers waiting for me, no SWAT team emerging from the woods. I was home, and I had gotten away with it. A surge of elation went through me, a feeling similar to what I'd felt in the meadow 15 hours earlier. I had changed the world, and no one would ever know it. And even if they found Brad's truck in New York City, they would assume that he had simply left it there. They would never find him, and they would never connect me to any of this. Miranda would be found dead, all evidence pointing to Brad Daggett as the killer. And Brad would disappear forever. The police would assume he went on the run, but they would never find him. Case closed. I remembered telling Ted that there were two ways to hide a body. One was literal, but the other way to hide a body was to hide the truth of it, to make it appear as though something else had happened to it. "We did it," I whispered as I got out of the car, allowing myself a moment to believe that there was someone out there to share this with me. My mother followed me into my house. I flipped on the foyer light and took her overnight bag from her. "Oh, so quaint," she said, as she always did when she came to my house.
Chapter 29. Kimball. By the time Detective James and I reached the Severson house in Kennewick, there was barely room to park our car along the driveway. It was already a jurisdictional mess, as we knew it would be. The entire Kennewick Police Department had turned out, but because of the limited resources of their detective department, the state police detectives had been called in as well. The chief medical examiner was there, and I heard that the U.S. Marshals Service had been advised that a possible murder suspect had most likely crossed state lines. We did manage to work our way into the house, getting past the miles of yellow police tape and about 7 uniformed officers, all determined to protect the scene. I'd seen the gigantic house from the outside the day before, when we'd been looking for Brad Daggett, but hadn't been inside yet. The foyer was the size of my apartment. Miranda Severson was face down on the unfinished floor. She wore an expensive-looking dark green coat over jeans and boots. One of her gloved hands was up near her destroyed head. Her hat, gray tweed with a short brim, had come off. Her black hair was loose, spilling around her head. It was hard to tell where the hair stopped and where the blood, dark and congealed, began. Together, the hair and the blood formed a black halo around her head. "Weapon?" I asked Chief Ireland, who had come up to stand next to me. He hadn't said anything yet. He was giving me a chance to look at the body.
"It just got bagged. 24-inch adjustable wrench, laid out right next to her."
He gestured vaguely toward one of the many portions of the dusty floor that had been marked with tape.
"What else they find?" "Plenty from the looks of it. Footprints, fibers, hairs. You missed the bagging party."
"Anything unusual?" I asked.
"You mean more unusual than a girl with her head beat in?"
"I mean anything that doesn't make it look like what it probably is. I mean anything that doesn't make it look like Brad Daggett panicked, brought her here, and beat her to death."
"Well, no. We didn't find the dropped wallet of the mayor of Kennewick, if that's what you mean. There were some pretty fresh tire tracks out front that didn't get run over by the dog and pony show. They look like truck tracks to me, and they probably belong to Daggett's F-150. So nothing really strange. I mean, if you ask me, it's all strange. She put her hand up to block the blow." Chief Ireland raised his own wide hand to the side of his head to demonstrate. "But that was all the fight she put up. So yeah, that's a little strange. He marches her in here holding a giant wrench, and she just stands there and lets him beat on her head."
"That is strange," I agreed. "No sign of there being anyone else in here besides the two of them?"
"Well, they photographed everything, so we'll wait and see. But just eyeballing it, I'd say no. What was odd was that it looked like she probably came in through the front door, and Dagger came in through the sliding glass doors. These ones right here. See those big prints? Those are his.
There was tape marking everything, but I picked out the small muddy ridges on the otherwise dusty floor that must have come from Brad's boots.
Why would he do that? I can think of some reasons, not necessarily good ones. Maybe the front door was locked, so while she looked for the key, he went around the back to see if the doors were open. Maybe he sent her into the house first, then went back, got his wrench, and came in the back door in order to sneak up on her and surprise her.
Well, that makes sense, I guess, I said. Maybe he wanted to look at the moonlight on the ocean.
You never know, I said.
One of Ireland's officers was waving him down from across the room. He excused himself and went over to him. I stood for a while longer, looking at the body, wondering about the footprints. James came over to me. She wore a gray London Fog trench coat over her black pantsuit. Stylish as always, except she wore a winter hat and Celtic screen with the awful logo of the little Irish leprechaun spinning a basketball on his finger.
What'd you find out? I asked her.
All signs point to Daggett. Time of death was probably 12 hours ago, which means he could be pretty far away.
He'll get caught, I said.
Oh, yeah, she said. I told her about the footprints that came in from the front and from the back as well. She thought about it for a moment.
Makes sense. He brings her here to kill her, but he can't walk in with a big wrench in his hand. So he makes an excuse to return to the truck, gets the wrench, then runs around to the back of the house.
Sliding doors were probably already unlocked. What makes less sense is how he talked her into coming to the house at all. I mean, if he told her he wanted to talk, they could have talked in the truck. It's not like this place is warm and comfortable.
Yeah, I know. That bothers me, too.
We stood for a moment quietly. Then I said,
Have you seen the view? Out the back?
No, she said. Together we walked toward the sliding glass doors that led to a stone patio, and through them out into the beautiful fall day. The view was stunning. The house was on a bluff directly over the Atlantic. You could see miles in all directions.
Was that going to be a pool, you think?
James asked about the wide hole dug in the sloping back lawn.
That'd be my guess, I said.
It's all a little bit obscene, not the location, but the size of the house. It looks more like a hotel than a place for a couple with no kids. I stepped out farther and turned back and looked up at the beige facade of the house. The second floor was lined with little balconies. One for every bedroom, I guessed. There was a built-in fireplace on the stone patio and a place for a grill and a mini-fridge. I wondered what would happen to this place. If someone would swoop in and pay to have it finished, or it would just languish and rot. Become a luxury home for a colony of bats or raccoons.
Another thing, James said.
She was still looking out at the ocean.
If our assumption is correct, if Miranda Severson talked Brad Daggett into killing her husband, he must have done it thinking he would come into all of this wealth eventually.
Maybe he was in love with her, James. Don't be cynical.
Whatever. It doesn't change my point. Which is, why does he kill Miranda less than a week after killing her husband? I mean, she's the reason he's doing all this. Killing her means it all goes away. No more money, no more sex.
Yeah, it's strange. It could be lots of reasons, though. He panics, thinks Miranda is going to turn him in.
If that's the case, then why not just run instead of killing her first and then running?
I don't know, he said. Maybe he acted alone. Maybe he'd fallen in love with Miranda, thought that killing the husband would make her fall into his arms. When that didn't immediately work, he killed Miranda so no one else could have her.
I thought of that, James said. But if that was the case, then how'd he get Miranda to agree to come here with him?
Well, we'll find out. They'll get him soon. 24 hours, tops. In the meantime, we've got a case to build. I'm going to go talk with this Polly Grenier, Brad's alibi for Friday night.
You need me?
I always need you, I said. But I can manage Polly. Something makes me think that as soon as I tell her we have a positive ID on Brad down in Boston, her alibi will break.
Okay. Call me if you need me. The state detectives want us to pass over all we have on the Ted Severson murder case, and I said I'd oblige.
After getting the address from Chief Ireland, I drove north to Kennewick Beach, passing Cooley's, the bar that Brad had supposedly been in with this Polly last Friday afternoon. From the beach road, I turned inland onto Sea Mist Road, going about a mile. The house is getting smaller, the woods getting thicker. Polly Grenier lived on a dead-end street called York Court, in a small single-story gray house situated on a yard that hadn't been mowed all summer. I double-checked the number on the mailbox. The house, blinds pulled down and all the windows, looked unlived in. I waded across the foot-high grass to the front door. The doorbell produced an echoey bong from within the house, and almost immediately, a blonde woman with a phone tucked between her shoulder and her chin swung open the door. I had my badge out.
"Chad, I gotta go," she said into the phone.
She kicked the screen door open a half inch and gestured me in.
"Yeah, yeah, I'll call you back. I gotta go. The police are here."
"What's going on?" she said to me after I'd scraped my feet on the welcome mat and entered the messy living area. "I'm here to ask you some questions about the last time you saw Brad Daggett. Would that be okay?"
"Oh, God, yeah, of course," she said.
She still held the phone in her hand. In her other was an unlit cigarette. She wore a long pink nubby robe, hanging loose in the front, the side of one of her heavy breasts visible. I kept my eyes on her face. She invited me in, bunching up a robe in the hand that held the cigarette, then pointed me toward a living area that contained a matching couch and recliner. A cocker spaniel in a dog bed turned his wet eyes toward me. Polly excused herself for a moment, and I sat down on the corduroy recliner. The house smelled of cigarettes and Febreze. When Polly came back into the living room, she was still wearing the robe, but had knotted it tightly around herself. Her blonde hair was pulled back, and it looked like she might have put a little bit of makeup on, but I couldn't be sure.
"Can I get you anything? Coffee?"
"If you're having some, sure. If not, I'm fine." She went and got us both a cup of coffee, adding milk and sugar to mine without asking. While I waited, I bent down and scratched the dog on the back of his head. He was old, I realized, his big eyes filmed with cataracts.
"That's Jack," she said,
when she handed me my coffee. I took a sip as Polly settled herself across from me on the couch. She crossed her legs and the robe fell away from her legs. She was heavy in the middle, her stomach bulging against the robe. But Polly Grenier had lovely legs, lightly tanned and beautifully shaped. Her toenails were painted an iridescent blue. I had wondered before coming here if Polly would have heard yet about the body in the Severson house. But I now knew that she had. I could tell as soon as she'd opened the door, the phone against her ear. She'd probably been talking about it all morning. "You've heard," I said, "about the body that was found this morning."
"Oh, yeah, it's all over town. Is it really Miranda Severson?"
"She hasn't been ID'd yet, but yes, we believe it's Miranda. But I'm here because of Brad Daggett."
"I don't know where he is. I swear to God, I told the police chief everything last night."
"No, I know," I said. "I didn't come here because I thought you might know where he is. I came here because I wanted to hear more about the last time you saw him. I heard from Chief Ireland that it was last Friday night."
"That's right."
"Can you tell me about it? I know you've been through it already, but I'd like to hear it as well." She told me how she and Brad had had an on-again, off-again romance since practically forever, all the way back to Kennewick High, and that they both still hung out at Cooley's, and occasionally hooked up, and that the last time this happened was Friday.
"I'm not proud of it, but we go way back, you know. Sometimes I thought we were destined to wind up together."
"You sure it was Friday?"
"Oh, yeah,"
she said, leaning forward and plucking her pack of Marlboro menthols off the table.
"You don't mind if I smoke, do you?" she asked.
"No, of course not.
You want one?"
"Sure," I said, and leaned across to pull one of the cigarettes from the hard pack. I usually only smoked hand-rolled cigarettes, but I figured it couldn't hurt to bond a little with Polly Grenier. She lit her cigarette first, then passed the Bic lighter over to me. I hadn't had a menthol in years, and the first minty drag punched me in the throat.
"How are you positive it was Friday?" I asked. "It's the only day of the week I get off work early. I do the 5-to-1 shift at Manor House Nursing Home on Friday. Afterward, I went to Cooley's for lunch, and that's where I saw Brad. We had a few drinks, and then went back to his place.
Did you plan on meeting him there, or was it just chance?
Half and half, really. I'd seen him earlier in the week, and he'd mentioned it to me. Asked me if I still got off early on Friday, and told me that he was planning on being at Cooley's, and maybe we could have a few drinks, celebrate the weekend.
Was that usual for the two of you, making plans to meet?
She blew a plume of blue smoke from her nostrils and rounded the ash of her cigarette against the edge of a glass ashtray on the coffee table.
No, not really. We didn't usually make plans. We just run into each other. It's a small town, you know.
Anything else unusual about that day? About Brad?
He was a little strange, I'll admit it. Like, he insisted on paying for my lunch and buying me beers. He was kind of all over me. I mean, that's happened a lot in the past, but not usually in the middle of the day. I thought it was weird, but I also kind of liked it. I thought maybe he'd gotten lonely since his marriage broke up and decided he wanted a girlfriend.
I finished my cigarette, put it out in the ashtray. Polly, Brad Daggett was positively ID'd as being in Boston on Friday night around 6 at night. Are you sure you want to stick to your story?
I don't understand. I was with him at his place.
I paused, took a sip of coffee to try to get the taste of menthol out of my mouth. I want to make this very clear, Polly. Brad is in big trouble. He's the prime suspect in 2 murders. If you're lying about Brad being with you, that means you are willfully obstructing justice, and you will do prison time. No doubt about it. She clamped a hand around her mouth. Her eyes looked shocked, but also confused.
Did Brad kill someone?
Were you with him on Friday night?
I was with him, but I don't know. I can't remember much. I think I might have passed out.
A voice had turned high-pitched. Jack, the Cocker Spaniel, lifted his head in concern, but stayed in his bed.
Just tell me exactly what you remember. If you tell me the truth, you're not going to get into trouble, okay?
We were pretty drunk when we left the bar, doing shots and stuff like that. Back at his place, we kept drinking.
What time was this?
I don't know exactly. 3, maybe? I got to Cooley's around 1, and we were there a couple hours. I don't know the exact...
That's okay. Around 3 is good enough. So you were both drinking. What were you drinking?
Jaeger shots, mostly. Then we started to fool around. We were pretty wrecked. Brad, he couldn't get it up. I remember that much. He said something like, well, let's sleep it off and try again, and then we went to sleep.
What time did you wake up?
It was late, I don't know, around 10 or something. I remember, because I looked at the clock and didn't know if it was 10 in the morning or 10 at night.
And Brad was there in bed with you?
No, but he was there, out in the living room watching TV. He drove me back to my car, Cooley's, and I went home. I felt like shit.
Polly, thank you. That is all very helpful. And you haven't heard from him or seen him since then.
God, no. Did he really do it? Did he kill them both?
Her hand was up around her face again, and her robe had gaped open. She had put her cigarette down in the ashtray without putting it out, and it smoldered away.
That's what we're trying to find out. Did he ever talk with you about either of the Seversons?
No, never. But him and the man were friends. They used to drink at Cooley's together. I met him once.
They drank together?
At least once. I remember he introduced me. He was the guy building that big house out on the cliff, right? They kind of seemed like friends.
And Miranda Severson, the wife. Did you ever see her at Cooley's?
No, never. I'd heard of her, but... Jesus Christ, I can't believe all this is happening.
She reached for her cigarette in the ashtray, saw that it was down to the filter, and crushed it out. I left her my card, told her to call me right away if she remembered anything else, then got back into my car. It was close to noon. My original plan had been to swing by Cooley's, talk to a bartender, see if I could corroborate Polly's story. But now I didn't feel the need. She was telling the truth. Brad had gotten her drunk, made sure she passed out at his house, then driven to Boston to kill Ted. I called James and told her what I'd found out, that Brad's alibi was never going to hold up.
She didn't sound surprised. She was still at the state police headquarters in Portland, Maine. I told her I'd pick her up there in an hour.